It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. The guilty verdict in the trial of former Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky, reached less than a year ago, has certainly brought the issue of child sexual abuse into the spotlight. For parents, kids, and teachers, what are the warning signs of potential sexual abuse? What questions should parents be asking before they let another adult spend time with their child? And how long should a person be held accountable for his or her past when kids are involved? These are questions explored in an investigative report released this week by our content partner, Public Source. The story follows a Pittsburgh area man named David Scott Zimmerman, a man at the center of a child sex abuse case who found himself once again working with teenaged boys in the wake of the Joplin, Missouri tornado. The piece was written by reporter Bill Heltzel, who joins us now in Studio A. Bill Heltzel, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul.
And if you have a comment or a question for our guest, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Bill, you say in your piece that the story of David Zimmerman strikes at the heart of how states regulate youth groups and what information should be discussed about the organizations or should be disclosed about the organizations and their staffs. So let's begin by having you explain who David Scott Zimmerman is and what about his past is troubling.
Well, Mr. Zimmerman was a coach and a teacher at Vincentian High School north of Pittsburgh in the 1990s. And in the late 90s, actually in the mid-90s, there was an accusation of improper conduct made against him, and nothing came of it. Then 3 years later, more athletes came forward, and eventually he was forced out of his job. And we looked at this case a year ago in advance of the Sandusky trial. We wanted to see how were similar cases handled on the local level. And basically what we found was that the cases are not well reported and they're not thoroughly investigated. In this case, there were accusations, and he made a deal with the high school. He said that he would not he would excuse them of any liability, and they would not comment on the circumstances of his leaving. And so he was able to leave his job with, at that point, a clean record. Now, McCandless police came in behind that and charged him with a couple of misdemeanors. And he entered a plea bargain, and eventually he got those cases expunged. So at this point, there's nothing on the criminal record involving those cases. That's why we initially wrote the story. We wanted to take a look at how these kinds of cases are handled locally.
So the first article you wrote with Hallie Stockton in June of last year, called Zimmerman Child Sex Abuse Case Shows Importance of Reporting, brings up questions about schools recognizing potentially abusive behavior and reporting it, not as you call it or as it is called or identified as passing the trash. Explain what you were trying to show here.
Well, in the idea of passing the trash is that a school becomes aware of problematic behavior, and rather than report it to the state officials who can then investigate it, remove the license and so forth, they make it go away. They make a deal with the person. And so that teacher or that coach can then go on to another school and pick up where he left off.
And why are schools making it go away?
I think you can just assume that these are very embarrassing situations. They don't want their reputation is at stake, they just don't want it out there.
You would think, though, that they would put the welfare of the students ahead of this, this concern over reputation, because by the very fact of their doing this, didn't that perhaps delay justice, if not for this man, for others who might not have been able to prey on kids, presumably, if some procedure had been in place to get the word out.
Well, you would hope so. I will point out that when the second round of accusations were made, Vincentian actually acted very quickly. They notified the prosecutor's office. They notified McCandless police. But then they made this secret deal. And at that point, they were. It appears that they were washing their hands of the situation.
In view of this, and certainly in the wake of the Sandusky situation, there are a number of laws being discussed and proposed at the state level. How would proposed laws make confidential deals like the ones we've been talking about here between Zimmerman and Vincentian, for example, make those deals impossible, if not illegal?
Well, one of the proposals, and I apologize, I don't know the exact status of that legislation, but there's a proposal to basically outlaw those kind of deals. There was a kind of a presumption in the past that you had to report them, but they're tightening up those. The proposal would tighten up those regulations and put more teeth into it. The teacher would have to report, disclose more about his background. Prospective teachers would have to put more information about their background, and it would be easier then to regulate.
What about organizations? How could you regulate, say, a foundation that works with kids?
I think that's one of the key issues here. You can require background checks. Of volunteers, for example. But the state really doesn't have a lot of leverage over volunteer organizations. They have leverage over teachers because they're teaching licenses. They have some leverage over childcare workers because there are licenses. But without licenses, it basically comes down to self-reporting. So in this case, the nonprofits that Mr. Zimmerman formed, he would have to self-report. So what incentive would he have to disclose his background if he knows that this is going to bar him from doing what he's trying to do?
We're talking with reporter Bill Heltzel with our content partner, Public Source. He's written an investigative piece which has come out this week following a Pittsburgh area man named David Scott Zimmerman, a man at the center of a child sex abuse case who found himself once again working with teenage boys in the wake of the Joplin, Missouri tornado. Which cases against Mr. Zimmerman were expunged?
These were the cases that were filed in 1999 by McCandless Police and the county prosecutor. They were for simple assault and corruption of minors. I think it's very interesting to point out, too, that we talk about sexual abuse. It's very murky exactly what he pleaded on in these cases. Simple assault can mean a lot of things. And because the records were expunged, we don't know precisely what he was admitting to. His version was that he just merely failed to supervise his athletes as well as he should have. When you read the police complaints, it's a lot different. But final analysis, we don't know precisely what he did back then. There was also a federal pornography charge, a child pornography charge. That was dropped because of a bad search warrant. So again, the record is ambiguous here.
How was it possible for the expunged records to come to light?
Several athletes and their families sued Mr. Zimmerman, and so we went to those case files and found records there. And also in the child pornography case, the application for search warrant contained the police records.
So how is Zimmerman's going to Missouri in the wake of the tornado, how is that indicative of how a child sexual predator operates in terms of grooming their victims and the people around them that they trust?
Well, to me, the intriguing thing about Joplin is that you had many people die. I think it was 158 people, 1,100 injured, 2,000 buildings destroyed. People were vulnerable. And all of a sudden, this guy from Pittsburgh comes in and wants to help. Again, I want to emphasize, it's very murky exactly what he did. We don't know what his intent was. You know, we don't know if it was good intent or bad intent. You can put it in the worst possible light and say that he took advantage of people when they were at their lowest. You could put it in a good light and say that here's a guy that came in and helped people when they were at their lowest. That part of it is murky. What is not murky is that he concealed information the whole way, on his website, on the Facebook page. He does not identify himself. People who'd want to check him out, and in fact, people in Joplin did try to check him out. They couldn't find out anything about him. And that enabled him to continue working with kids. Again, we don't know that what his intent was.
True, but we do know from your reporting that did he not, in fact, bring some of these youngsters, say, you know, look, I want to help them get away from all this misery. I'm from Pittsburgh. I'm going to take them. He did, in fact, take some of these youngsters from one particular family, the Hare family, brought them here, took them to a Pirates game. And also, these were minors, gave them alcohol.
He brought several boys to Pittsburgh in 2011. I believe all three of them were 18 years old at that time. And yes, the boy said that he did serve them alcohol on a regular basis. He denies that. In the second trip in 2012, the boys were minors.
So we don't know exactly what the intentions were, but to a point, this follows the pattern of his behavior as a coach here in Pittsburgh.
You certainly can make that argument. He has put himself in a position to work with young men.
Did the Hare family in Joplin approach you after the first article you wrote about Zimmerman in June of last year, which would have been a year or so after his visit to Missouri?
No, actually what happened was the story came out last June, and we were not aware of these foundations that he was involved with. One of his volunteers, a man from Chicago, just came upon it by happenstance, saw the article, became alarmed by it, and contacted Mr. Zimmerman, and he denied that this was him. There was a mugshot in the story from the sheriff's department, or excuse me, from the Allegheny County Jail. He said that was a Christmas photo. He's denied that he was a teacher. So this volunteer contacted us, a public source, and said, do you stand by your story? At this point, we didn't know if the David Zimmerman that he was talking about was the same David Zimmerman that we had written about.
And we're going to follow more of the threads of this story and also welcome in Dr. Rachel Berger of the Statewide Task Force on Child Abuse when we return from a break. We're talking about a public source report here on Essential Pittsburgh today. It's about how a former coach with a troubled past could end up working with teens again. We'll continue our conversation with the man who reported that story for Public Source, Bill Heltzel, and welcome in Dr. Rachel Berger when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about a Public Source report released this week about how a former Pittsburgh area coach, David Scott Zimmerman, who has a troubled past, could work with teens once again. We're continuing with our guest, Public Source reporter Bill Heltzel, and welcoming in now Dr. Rachel Berger, a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and a member of the Statewide Task Force on Child Abuse. Dr. Berger, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
And we will bring you into the conversation in a moment here, but I wanted to just follow up with Bill here and just clarify a couple of points as we talk about the story that you broke, that that you've continued to follow with an article that was published this week, looking into how David Scott Zimmerman went to Missouri and earned the trust of a family there in the wake of the Joplin, Missouri tornado and ended up working with teens once again. What was the purpose of digging deeper into this story, especially since the Hare family in Joplin didn't have a case against Zimmerman?
I mean, I think we had an obligation once we became aware that he had these activities through the foundations. There were actually two groups, one in Joplin that where he persuaded the family to form the foundation, and he was very active in it. And then one in Florida that he founded, and basically took the Facebook members from the Joplin group with him. To me, the key issue here was disclosure. As I looked into these foundations, there was nothing about his background. You couldn't see a photo of him on the sites. You couldn't see his name on the sites. And I found that troubling. Again, we don't know what's in his heart. We don't know that he's doing anything bad. But I think at the very least, what we know with certainty is that he is not disclosing his background. And when the parents heard about this, when the volunteers heard about this, they were very, very upset.
Rachel, when you discuss a person like Mr. Zimmerman, and you're hearing us talk about this particular story, and we have to give, certainly in journalism, you must give someone the benefit of the doubt. It's like the law, you're innocent until proven guilty. And yet, this man has a record. And when you hear about a story like this, what is your reaction to it? And how willing are you to say, well, we just don't know exactly what this man might be thinking?
I think when I hear a story like this, it reminds me of why we tell parents that people who are sexual predators, we sometimes call them, groom their victims, that they sometimes have patterns. I think this is a very concerning pattern. You see a person moving from state to state. You see a person who's pled to different types of charges, none of which reach the level of a felony, so they're not on any type of federal list. So that allows them from go to state to state. And you see people, though there are many opportunities to volunteer, they're always finding themselves in situations where there are young men that they can volunteer to, quote, help. And so while I absolutely agree that we don't know enough in this case to know, there have been multiple concerns over a long period of time, which for various reasons, in one case a search warrant, in one case a plea, in one case an expungement. But clearly in hindsight, you know, each one of these individually are very concerning. But we also have to remember that this started in 1995 at a time where I think people were much less concerned about issues of sexual abuse. And I think if the same case occurred today, I think there might be a very different trajectory.
Is that because of Sandusky or other things?
I think in part Sandusky. I think even before Sandusky, there had been a cultural change where we had begun to talk about sexual abuse. People had begun to report sexual abuse more. There were DAs that now their expertise is in prosecuting sexual and physical abuse. That didn't happen 20 years ago. So I think there has been a cultural change. So if this same person were to operate or do this today, I'm not sure people would be so quick to allow charges to be expunged, to allow pleas down to a misdemeanor level. And we also have Megan's Law, which was really put in place to try to avoid, you know, child abuse charges are state-based, but Megan's Law is a federal law. So I think there are a lot of things in place today that were not in place in 1995.
We're talking here on Essential Pittsburgh about a story by our content partner, Public Source, looking into the case of a Pittsburgh man, David Scott Zimmerman, who found himself at the center of a child sex abuse case, who found himself once again working with teenage boys in the wake of the Joplin, Missouri tornado. And we're talking with the man who wrote the piece, Bill Heltzel. We are also talking with Dr. Rachel Berger, a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and a member of the statewide task force on child abuse. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions, call us, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Where do you think we should draw the line between individual rights and protection of minors? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Certainly a key question, and I would throw that question out to either of you, our guests. Where do we draw the line between individual rights and protecting our children?
Well, certainly he has a right to make a living. And
he being Mr. Zimmerman.
Mr. Zimmerman. And again, the
well, he certainly has made that case that, you know, I haven't done anything that I'm ashamed of? And why are you picking on me? In fact, didn't he contact you?
No, I contacted him.
Okay, and his response was, why are you singling me out?
Exactly, exactly. From his point of view, he has never admitted wrongdoing, except that he entered a plea agreement, but he has never admitted to the core accusations against him. Mr. Zimmerman, I think he believes that he's righteous. But to me, the issue here, again, is it's disclosure. These cases happened in the 1990s, but the organizations that he's involved with, they were formed in 2011, 2012. The organizations specifically work with young men, mostly. There are also some girls who participate. He is putting himself out there, and I think at that point, when he is putting himself out there to work with youth, the parents whose children are interested, the volunteers who are interested, the sponsors and donors who are interested, are entitled to some background information so they can make an informed choice. He actively concealed that background, and I think that's the issue here.
What, Rachel, are the clear warning signs here? And for some, they would seem to be obvious, and yet in the case of a father in Missouri, a distraught father who allows this man to take his teenage children, out of state, trusts him enough to do that, even though he really doesn't know him that well. Granted, the man was dealing with a tragedy in his own family and was vulnerable. But what are the signs that he should have been looking for? What are the signs that you would recommend that any parent in any situation be looking for?
Well, I think one of the warning signs we always have to be looking for is asking ourselves the question, why does this person want to spend so much time with my children? No one should want to spend as much time with your children as you. And so if there's somebody that seems very, very eager for one reason or another to take your children different places, do things with your children that you can't afford or cannot do because you don't have enough time, I think you have to have a healthy skepticism about why that's the case. Clearly, people who are good people search out people who are vulnerable, but people who also are not good people and are looking for, another victim are also going to search out people who are vulnerable. So I would say vulnerable families and vulnerable children who are often in vulnerable families are the ones most likely to be hurt by a sexual predator. So I think overall, families just need to be careful. And when children are involved in any kind of organization, I think it is the responsibility of a parent to say, how do you screen your volunteers? And when someone comes to you and wants to watch your child, you need to ask, to yourself at least, why does this person want to watch my child?
Do people understand how widespread similar cases are, that in so many of these cases there just are similar traits, there are similar character traits, there are similar patterns of behavior, and things progress to the point of abuse in much the same way in many of these cases?
I think part of the problem is once we recognize it, hindsight is always 20/20. And there are many fabulous volunteers that may meet some of the same criteria that Mr. Zimmerman did. And so I think part of it is, as we look back and it seems obvious now, I think when we are in the real time, we have to question at every step when somebody takes on four new foundations and all of a sudden now they're also in a church organization and all of a sudden something crosses a line and it makes people uncomfortable. I think we have to right then and there, so why is this making me uncomfortable?
If we go through a brief timeline on Zimmerman's history, and it is quite extensive following, all of the different things that he is tied to. The first accusations in 1998 where he was barred from working with kids for a year, the 1998 case that led to the 2001 child porn possession charge, which was dismissed on a technicality, sexual assault of a 20-year-old in 2008, and potentially the purchase of alcohol for minors in 2011, but no charges, even though the kids he was looking after say he did, in fact, buy them alcohol. How would the laws proposed in the wake of the Sandusky case that are being discussed in the that have been discussed in the legislature and are now proposed legislation. How would this how would these measures stop this progression of incidents?
I think it's really important to understand that the laws that are being proposed only affect Pennsylvania, and they only affect the school situation. These are not laws. So I think if you look at the trajectory here, there were actually multiple systems at multiple times. There was the criminal system at one point. There was probably the federal system through the pornography charge. So the what we're addressing in the state is this idea of pass the trash. So in the educational system, there's an obligation of a person who's applying, and also in the when you do volunteer work, to find out where the person has been and all the employers after their age of 18 or for the last 10 years. And it's the obligation of that school to check out those references before they hire that person. So there's like a 60-day period when they can – the proposal is a 60-day period when they the school can check out those references. So that the only system that we're trying to affect in Pennsylvania or that can be affected by this law is this system, the Megan's Law system, the federal law. That's not going to be affected. But again, Mr. Zimmerman was actually interacted with multiple different systems, and so other systems have also changed. So there were actually multiple ways at which potentially there could have been changes in the trajectory here.
So does this help us answer the question of which I'm sure many people have to be asking and scratching their heads about, which is why wasn't this man identified sooner? Why and why aren't other sexual predators identified sooner?
Well, I'd point out that the initial charge or accusation, I should say, in 1995, he was not charged with any wrongdoing at that point, but a basketball player came forward and told his principal that Mr. Zimmerman had tried to make him masturbate to hide a secret. The boy had falsified his grades, so he was using that as leverage over the boy. The boy was not taken seriously at that point. So the right from the get-go, and I think Dr. Berger addressed this, 20 years ago or 18 years ago, there wasn't as much sensitivity perhaps to grooming behavior, and they didn't have the systems in place necessarily to address this. When you fast forward to 1998, when more players came forward, the school did take it more seriously, but they also were protecting their reputation, apparently, by entering this secrecy deal with Mr. Zimmerman. So, there was an improvement there, but they still helped him conceal what was going on. As far as we know, he still has a teacher's license. Theoretically, he could teach. Now, I think it's unlikely, but he has a license. So that system failed.
I think the fundamental issue is that as a society, we believe adults more than we believe children. And in almost every case you look back on, the Sandusky case was reported very, very early on, and the system didn't believe that the adult had done this. And over we see this. So as long as we have a culture where we believe adults more than we believe children, and that's still the case today. There are many cases in sexual abuse that you can't bring a case to a trial if you only have one child, because the jury will not believe one child over an adult. So you almost have to wait until you have multiple allegations and multiple children, because otherwise, as a society, we don't believe those children until there's many corroborating stories. So I think a lot of this can happen because culturally and societally, adults take a different – people believe adults more than they believe children, and that's not something that's easy to change.
I think you also find out in many of these cases that the accused actually is quite popular. They're very involved in their communities. They don't – they groom the parents as well as the children. In this case, Mr. Zimmerman was a very – good basketball coach. He took a losing program and turned it into a winning program at a small school. That was a big deal. He was very popular, and I think that is part of what Dr. Berger is talking about. There's a credibility issue here. A teenage boy says something bad happened, and he's accusing a popular coach. I mean, it's the dynamics of that don't favor the kid.
Do we have to be careful though, and I understand what you are saying, Dr. Berger, about when an adult is believed and the word of a single child is often not taken. But do we also need to be concerned simply about a case or a situation where one child might be making something up about an adult or a teacher?
Absolutely. We always need to be concerned whether there are other motives, why there is a reason the child might be lying. And we do have much better systems in place today. That's why we have people who do what's called forensic interviews. They interview children with the police watching, with Child Protective Services watching. They judge how believable the child is, and they're trained to do this. And so we do have ways that help us to know whether a child is believable. But I think the other thing we have to remember is that in order to keep our children safe, adults may need to lose a small amount of their liberty, perhaps not in the criminal system, but the design of the Child Protective Services system was to have a lower level by which you need to be concerned so that people don't work with children. There are many ways that you can earn a living that don't involve children. And so when there are credible concerns, maybe that don't rise to a criminal level, there are still maybe concerns that rise to the level within the Child Protective Services system that we need to be very careful about that particular adult.
And when you say a small amount that you know, perhaps we need to risk having adults lose a small amount of their liberty, what specifically are you referring to?
All I'm saying is that I think that we have to understand that we will never be 100% right. And there's always the question of which way do you need to err on? Do you err on the side of protecting the rights of adults, or do you err on the side of protecting the rights of all the children that may come into contact with the adults? And clearly, as a pediatrician, I'm more leaning toward the side of we need to protect the rights of all the children, perhaps with that single adult losing some of their liberty. Clearly, there are other people that will be at other sides of that spectrum.
Before we wrap this up, Bill Heltzel, in your reporting, you mentioned in one of the pieces that you've done on this that the state's proposal here in Pennsylvania is based on a 2010 Oregon law. Explain what that law does.
Well, the Oregon law just made it tougher for administrators to make secret deals. Essentially, they're held to a higher standard. So that if anything happens with a teacher, if a teacher is dismissed, you need to know why that teacher is dismissed, regardless of the reason. You can't just paper it over.
So with this in place, would we perhaps eliminating the secret deals? Can we create a lot more transparency here, which would then lead to better reporting and maybe heading off some of these incidents?
Certainly. And the sad fact is that a lot of times we don't know about these cases until there have been many victims. But I think what the system is trying to do, what the Child Protection Task Force is trying to do, is to catch it earlier so that there are fewer victims.
Well, it's certainly an interesting piece that you have written. And again, if you're not familiar with it, our content partner, Public Source, Bill Heltzel, who we've been speaking with, has brought to our attention the story of David Scott Zimmerman. The piece is called Former Coach with Troubled Past Works with Teens Again. You can find a link to that story just out this week on our website at WESA.FM. And I want to thank you both for being a part of a fascinating conversation here on the program today. Bill Heltzel is a reporter with Public Source and has done some intensive investigative work on this story. Also, thanks to Dr. Rachel Berger, a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and a member of the statewide task force on child abuse. Thank you both for being with us here today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris tells us where prospective business owners can find financial backing when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.